Ubi caritas et amor Deus ibi est, congregavit nos in unum Christi amor. Exultemus et in ipso iucundemus, timeamus et amemus Deum vivum, et ex corde diligamus nos sincero. Ubi caritas et amor Deus ibi est, simul ergo cum in unum congregamur, ne nos mente divide.
Hello friends, this is Blaise Bonpain with World Focus. In this time of hype, I'd like to offer you some ancient music. The translation from the Latin is simply, where there's charity and love, God is there. An ancient and meaningful chant, good music for a time of war. I recently visited the Valley Alternative School to talk about peace together with a group of Vietnam veterans. The high school seniors were eager to hear about Washington's war mania. In preparation for this visit, I was reading about the No Child Left Behind Act, a sweeping education law passed earlier this year. It is 670 pages long, and it includes a requirement for public secondary schools to provide military recruiters not only access to their facilities, but also with contact information for every student. This means that when the principal of a high school receives a letter from military recruiters demanding a list of all students, including names, addresses, and phone numbers, the school officials are expected to comply. And what if they don't? They face a cutoff of all federal aid. Never mind that this is a violation of the current student privacy laws. Unfortunately, recruiters do not tell the truth. They speak of education, travel, and good times, but they fail to make it clear that when you get into the service, you will do what you are told or go to military prison. One of the veterans said he had 73 troops under his direction. He said they had all been told of educational opportunities in the service and that exactly three of them received any educational opportunity at all. It seems that the lies begin in kindergarten. Students are told that George Washington could not tell a lie. The story is a falsehood concocted by a reverend who wanted to teach children not to lie. Education is very disrespectful of the intelligence of children. Kindergarten students could easily discuss the merits of war and peace. They should be taught about the Holocausts imposed on the indigenous, the slaves, the Armenians, the Jews, the Vietnamese, the Central Americans, and the Iraqis in their earliest years of grade school. I felt a great sadness as I reflected on the fact that student alumni of this high school went off to die as the enemy in places where they were not wanted. They did not know the issues. They did not know the history. They did not know the motivation for the very war in which they died. They were condemned to repeat history because they had not studied it. There are now over 500,000 high school students in the junior ROTC nationwide. Funds are taken from the budget of the Los Angeles Unified School District to pay for this military training. Non-credentialed trainers are teaching the students to aim, shoot, and kill at the very time we are trying to get the guns out of our schools. One-third of the homeless people in Los Angeles are veterans. The government's historic rejection of veterans is traceable from the Revolution of 1776 to the Gulf War. A substantial percentage of the veterans of the Gulf War are suffering from the effects of depleted uranium, chemical warfare, and medical experimentation. They are victims of our own friendly fire. What to do? Support our students by avoiding an absolutely unnecessary war in Iraq. Support our troops by not sending them into harm's way for oil company profits. Join us from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, November 22nd, at the Westwood Federal Building, Wilshire and Veteran.
Christus Deus, ubi caritas et amor Deus ibi est, simul quoque cum beatis videamus, gloriante vultum tuum, Christe Deus, gaudium quod est immensum, atque probum, saecula per infinita, saeculorum.
Today I'm very honored to have a world-class filmmaker here in the studio, Gerard Ungerman. Welcome to KPFK.
Thank you very much, Blaise, for having me today.
We're just thrilled with your achievement, The Hidden Wars of Desert Storm. It reflects on this whole matter of chemical warfare. And how long did you spend there in Iraq and shooting that?
In Iraq itself, we spent a bit over a month. Mm-hmm. That was probably the shorter part of our work on this documentary, Hidden Wars of Desert Storm. It's a project that took us about a year and a half altogether.
Indeed. Everyone here at Pacifica has just been thrilled with it. As you know, we've used it as a premium on our fundraising, and it may be one of the reasons we did so well in the last fundraiser. And where else has it been seen? Tell us about the New York Times evaluation of your film.
Well, at this point, there are two different avenues for distributing it and showing it. There's television, on the one hand, and it has actually been much stronger in Europe. At this point, this documentary has been shown in all European countries, with the exception of the UK, actually. It has been shown in Canada, and here, as far as TV stations, it has been shown on Free Speech TV and WorldLink TV. And actually, as far as I know, one PBS affiliate, WYBE, in Philadelphia. And here, we have what we don't have in Europe. We have grassroots organizations, public screenings, usually put together by people who, you know, do some form of peace activism, anti-war activism. And we are so we have been blessed also with the whole Pacifica visibility, because we went from selling maybe a couple, you know, tapes over our website a day to now, you know, we had like days when we sold like 100, you know, over 100 copies in a day. That has been a blessing.
Well, look, you explained to us in the film, you showed us the war in Iraq. Now we're back again, preparing for another war in Iraq. So it's extremely important that people see what you did. I mean, you talk about depleted uranium, right?
Mm. Yes, that's one
of the... This is atomic warfare.
Yeah. It is. I mean, there's a debate on the vocabulary, but at least it's certainly a radioactive warfare. You mentioned depleted uranium rounds. That it's one thing that we had no idea of before starting this research, for instance. And even though, I had been myself in the military 5 years, and I'm pretty sure I fired some of these rounds, because there are now many countries, so-called developed countries, are using these rounds. That was a big shocker to us to discover the cynicism of basically using this material, which happened to have the property of being extremely high perforation material. And it's there, it's free, it's for the grab, it's actually, it's being stockpiled, it has been stockpiled for now half a century, and I guess some genius realized what they could do with it, and they're just trying to, I don't know, it seems to be like sheer lunacy. It's digging out radioactive material, shipping it as core of either perforation bullets, rockets, and just, you know, knowingly spreading this material, which is extremely radioactive, all over battlefields, with no concern whatsoever for the soldiers firing it, for the soldiers being fired at, for the population living in the vicinity. It's something which just, it's so big it kind of blow you away. You hardly believe in it.
What about the veterans who came home? It appears that approximately 25% of them came home with a specific illness known as the Gulf War illness.
Well, it seems, as some veterans say, this war was the toxic soup war. There were many different agents of pollution and toxicity. There are things which, you know, are non-controversial now, like the anthrax vaccines that were not tested, like the fact that the engineer corps of the U.S. Army blew some stockpiles of Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons, probably to hide their origins, many European countries and in this country here. And some troops were actually in the vicinity, and plumes of that toxic, you know, clouds flew out of them. So that's another thing. So veterans have been exposed to months of all-weather fires. It's one of the worst pollution that happened in the 20th century. And so you wonder why, when it's so easy for the military, you know, what it takes to put off a fire like this. It's heavy tank type vehicles, explosives, something the military is not short of, and, you know, they let these fires burn for months, possibly as a decoy, so that's further down, if people start, you know, getting sick, they could say, oh, well, maybe it was Saddam's fault because of the fire. And of course, the radioactive ammunitions.
For over 11 years now, we have been talking about one man. That is, our president is talking about one man, Saddam Hussein. And in talking about eliminating one man, we have killed 1.7 million people. I think organized crime would consider that a very sloppy record, going after one individual and killing 1.7 million. Now, I think that your film has helped people to understand just how much of a war crime we're dealing with here. And we're yet on the verge of doing this again. And I'm just so grateful to you and to Audrey for making this film. And I hope the whole world will see it. And I do hope that PBS has the backbone to show the film across the country. It's only a few stations that have shown it so far. And not only have you done Iraq, but now you have done one of the great areas of violence in the world, Colombia. You recently were in Colombia. What part did you spend your time in Colombia?
We tried to travel throughout, well, not all of Colombia. It's a very big country.
Indeed it is.
But we of course spent time in Bogota, the capital, in the center. We went in the Putumayo region in the south, which is a very conflictual area. We spent time actually in FARC territory, which used to be actually as a peace, demilitarized peace zone,
exactly,
until it was,
yes,
actually terminated in February by then President Pastrana. We spent time in the jungle in the north, close to the border with Panama. We went to Medellin, and we went also to Barranca Bermeja, which is an oil city, in our flight north of Bogota.
Did you see the impact of the pesticide Roundup in Colombia?
Actually, yes. We did see some chunks of forest fields burnt by this Roundup Ultra. It's good that you mentioned that it's Roundup Ultra and not just Roundup. It's a much enhanced formula which has not been disclosed and probably will not be disclosed. And we see the ominous green barrels that they're using for these fumigations, but they seem to be extremely toxic and very strong. I mean, you'll see in our film that there you can see entire forests which have been completely burned by that.
This is Blaise Bonpain. I'm speaking to filmmaker Gerard Ungerman, who has just completed a film on Plan Colombia. And one of the delegations that just came back, Gerard, said the pesticides are killing everything but the coca, which I thought was very interesting. It was killing all the food, and the coca plants apparently are quite strong, and they didn't fade out as quickly as the food did.
Well, coca, just actually like also marijuana, it's a weed, and weeds have the property to be very strong. And what happened is you have to really concentrate your dispersal of that Roundup Ultra on that weed to kill it. And on the one hand, first of all, they usually fly at fairly high elevations because the fumigations are concentrated in areas controlled by the FARC or the ELN, not the paramilitary. Actually, it's important to notice this. And because of safety concern, planes can be fired at, you know, by the local guerrillas. They fly fairly high, which means that they have to concentrate around the Ultra a lot. And also the dispersal is very great, so you don't really target specifically the coca plant. So first of all, the effect on it is fairly minimized by the lack of concentration on it. And it's true, it's a weed that even if you do, you know, spray close enough and you kill it, farmers are kind of laughing at it because, you know, 6 months later, you know, the forest will still be damaged, but this type of weed will grow again.
Then you went up to the area known as Urabá, the northern part of Colombia, just under Panama.
Yeah.
Now, in that area is the Chocó, the area of the former slaves in Panama, mm-hmm. the African Colombians. I know on our trip there, we saw them being exiled out of their area. They wound up in Turbo. Did you see some of that impact of the attacks on the African Colombian community?
Oh yes, absolutely. Actually, we spent time with a community called Cacarica, mm-hmm. That actually returned to their land after several years of violence, and it's a situation where. First of all, it's kind of hard to look at these issues without having some kind of historical background. That's what we do in the film. There's a whole history, actually, of post-colonialism that didn't really fade away, you know, in Colombia as in other countries. It's a situation where you have castes of people who are in power, usually white people, and they have a complete... they don't have a nation vision. It's more like a clan, caste kind of vision. It's like the interest of my family, of my clan, but not the interest of the nation. So there was never any kind of reinvestment to build infrastructures in Colombia. And you go to areas away from big cities. There's no road, there's no electricity, there's barely running water. And there's a big, you know, racism factor where, well, it's not, you know, just in these parts. It tends to be almost universal. But there's a big lack of concern and racism against these populations. And when they happen to be in areas where you have resources, oil, Colombia has gigantic oil reserves, or there's interest to build, say, a harbor, or there's interest to build, say, a highway, the military and the paramilitary are basically terrorizing these communities to basically shoo them away from their land. And the typical technique is you're going to have a band, you know, usually of paramilitaries showing up in a village. They're going to take somebody at random, and they're going to basically chop the person alive, you know, with a chainsaw in front of the entire village to terrorize people. And of course, what do people say? And what do you know? They run away. And now we have a situation where in Colombia, Colombia today has the third largest population of internal refugees in the world.
Oh, indeed it does. Friends, I'm talking to Gerard Ungerman about his new film on Plan Colombia, and I'd like to invite you to a benefit showing of this film, which will be hosted by KPFK morning show host Sonali Kahatkar. That's going to be Saturday, November 23rd. There's going to be two showings, 7 p.m. and 9 p.m. at the Raleigh Theater, 5300 Melrose Avenue in Los Angeles. Now, for ticket information on this new film, call 626-403-2530. 626-403-2530. I think this film is going to be extremely important, and it's very important to see it because Colombia is part of this great so-called war on drugs, which has been 20 years of failure, 20 years of wasted money. Hundreds of billions of dollars have been spent on the war on drugs, and I think that the supply of drugs has certainly increased in the meantime, and we should, I hope, concentrate on rehabilitation. Now, you spoke, Gerard, of the paramilitary. I saw them at San Jose Apartado, and you can't distinguish them from the military. They're the same uniform.
Well, you have, you know, paramilitary is one word, covers actually different realities. You have different types of paramilitary. The origin of the paramilitary phenomenon actually originates pretty much 50 years ago when, again, it's not just a Colombian reality. It happened in many other, you know, places. You have rich landowners who basically build their own little private armies for protection, and also sometimes also for, just like it happened in this country, in the U.S., when you know, big cattle ranchers had their goons basically scare away mostly sheep keepers to get their land, and it's the same phenomenon. And this phenomenon was kind of organized in the early 60s under President Kennedy. They had sent special forces to actually, when there was, because again, the guerrilla movement has been in existence in Colombia for a long time, for actually over half a century now. And because guerrillas tend to control the countryside as opposed to the cities, it has been perceived in the context of the Cold War as a threat by Washington, because at the time there was definitely this polarity between Washington and Moscow, and Moscow did help leftist movements around the world. So it was perceived as of importance for Washington to train Latin American militaries, and the Colombians in particular, to fight this new type of warfare. So they transform the training of the military that was more traditional border interdiction training to inside the borders guerrilla type, fighting. And what they did is they organized systematically local groups that they armed very well to be some kind of irregular auxiliaries to the local military. And they were very illegal at the time, and they were probably more able to live on the land and kind of try to infiltrate the guerrillas, try to coerce the local peasantry into supporting them as opposed to supporting the guerrilla. And things started to evolve again in the late 70s, early 80s, when first marijuana, then eventually coca, started to become a permanent equation in the entire political spectrum in Colombia. You had a situation where actually many, because of the permanent drug, vacuum cleaner, in the U.S. mostly, it became such a huge industry, and you had a lot of people jumped in, this bonanza, not just flamboyant type drug dealers like Pablo Escobar or the Ochoa brothers, Carlos Leder, to mention the most famous ones, but you had also more low-key people. Industrialists, landowners started to get involved in this, and it was a boosting phenomenon for everybody in the conflict, because it brought millions and millions of dollars, eventually billions, and it brought a lot more weapons that were sold mostly actually here in the U.S. to everybody. Actually both sides, on the guerrilla side and the military paramilitary side. And these groups eventually were the paramilitary. The group were outlawed at the time when it became apparent that the most virulent of these groups were actually goons belonging to drug lords.
Gerard, on this very day, there's a huge demonstration, the greatest religious demonstration in the United States, at Fort Benning, Georgia, where possibly 14,000 people, many of them from religious backgrounds, will be invading Fort Benning, Georgia, because so much of the training of these Colombians has come from that School of the Americas. And it's extremely important that it be shut down. And that's what Father Roy Bourgeois has been dedicating his time to. And I want to remind our listeners that we're going to have a chance to see this benefit preview showing of this new film on Plan Colombia, which has been produced by Gerard Ungerman and Audrey Brochi. Their second film, their first one was The Hidden Wars of Desert Storm, which is a magnificent documentary exposing the entire Gulf War I. Now, this exclusive showing will be hosted by Sonali Kahotkar of KPFK on Saturday, November 23rd. There's going to be two showings, one at 7 p.m., one at 9 p.m., at the Rally Theater, 5300 Melrose in Los Angeles. For ticket information, call 626-403-2530, 626-403-2520. I think that when will your film be ready? Is it ready now to show? Is it all put together?
The documentary is all put together. There's in particular a detail is we because again we work on shoestring budgets. We didn't have enough money to buy some archives that we needed for the film in Colombia. So we actually got from three sources in Colombia images on VHS with temp code. So we inserted these images that are where they should be in the documentary, but they have temp code, so we cannot sell this documentary at this point. Mm-hmm. So one of the things why we need this fundraiser next week is, among other things, to be able to buy these images and replace, you know, clear images for the ones that we have now.
I hope our listeners will participate in this Saturday, November 23rd. This is the Raleigh Theater, 5300 Melrose Avenue in Los Angeles, and there's going to be an exclusive showing of Plan Colombia, which has been a source of our spending, making Colombia one of the largest recipients of military aid in the entire world. And once again, it seems we're on the wrong track. The people of Colombia have been fighting since 1948. That's in the first half of the 20th century. They have been fighting all of this time for social justice and human rights. And unfortunately, their whole message is still being truncated by simply saying it's a drug problem. It's a social justice problem that has to be dealt with. We hope it could be dealt with. On our trip there, Gerard, we asked the UN if they might mediate when we went back up to Bogota. And they're more than willing to mediate. But they told us quite maybe quietly, they said it'll depend on your country. In other words, sadly, their permission to mediate an end to this struggle depends on the power of the U.S. Our country mediated, allowed the mediation in the case of Guatemala, and the UN did a good job. They allowed the mediation in the case of El Salvador, and the UN did a good job there. But it's tragic that we, our country, has to accept or allow them permission to mediate. Did you refer to the UN in your film?
Yes, absolutely. We interviewed a gentleman who was actually the local delegate of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights in Bogota, Amerigo Calcaterra, and we talk about all these issues.
Wonderful. Gee, Gerard, time is up. I'm so sorry that we've used all of our time. I want to thank Gerard Ungerman for being with us today, the producer of The Hidden Wars of Desert Storm and the film Plan Colombia, which you can see on November 23rd. Just call 626-403-2530. Thank you so much for being with us, Gerard.
Thank you,
Blaise. This is Blaise Bonpain with Focus on the Americas. For a copy of this, call us at 323-852-9808. 323-852-9808. Congregavit nos in unum.